Take your Bibles, please, and open them to the book of Daniel, chapter number 2. And because I have not been back to the office, my King James Bible that I would normally preach from is at the office, so I'll be preaching from the Bible that I have here at home, which is a New American Standard. Daniel chapter 2. We closed last Sunday with Pastor Dixon's sermon in the morning, where he covered essentially verses 1 through 7 and a lot of the historical background to the entire book of Daniel, as well as to this introduction to the book in chapter 1. And we learned that there are basically several principal characters that are introduced in chapter number 1. First, that there's this king, Jehoiakim, who was the king of the southern kingdom of Judah, and he was a wicked king. He did not listen to the prophets. He did not listen to the foretelling of what would happen if the people did not obey. And as a result, it says in verse 1 of chapter 1 that in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. So you see instantly the result of their rebellion. You see essentially that King Jehoiakim, I mean, he got what he had coming. And this other character that's introduced, and he'll be introduced for the next four chapters, he'll be actually one of the principal characters for the next four chapters, is this king, is this king Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was the son, as we mentioned last time, of a king named Nabopolassar. Nabopolassar began to go on a conquest of the various, of the various nations around him. And as his son Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilling that campaign, Nabopolassar ends up dying and Nebuchadnezzar ascends to the throne. And Nebuchadnezzar goes and ransacks then Jerusalem on his way back to Babylonia, and particularly to his city of Babylon. And as he goes back, he takes a bunch of captives from the royal line of the king of Judah. And amongst those are the four other principal characters of the first half of the book of Daniel, namely Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. That was their Hebrew names. And these four young men were most likely between the ages of 13 and 15 years old. They're just in their early to mid-teen years. And they're forced then to fulfill what King Nebuchadnezzar required of them, namely that they would undergo a rigorous treatment and education for 3 years. And at the end of those 3 years, that they would then be presented before King Nebuchadnezzar, and he would examine them, most likely an oral examination. And then if he found them fit to work for him, then essentially they would work for him and the Babylonian Empire. But one of the things that Nebuchadnezzar had required of them was that they not only undergo the education of Babylonian culture, or Chaldean culture, another word we use for the Babylonian people. Not only were they supposed to undergo Chaldean culture, Chaldean language, they were also supposed to undergo the exact same diet treatment as the king himself did. And it tells us in chapter 1, verse 8, that Daniel made up his mind he was not going to do that. He purposed in his heart that he would not do that. And you may have wondered, well, why was that? And we looked last Sunday night at the possibilities. And it could have been that the food was offered to idols, and Daniel and his three friends could have basically said, you know what, our conscience will not let us do that. In order to do that, we would be saying that there's credence to these false gods. And that's a possibility. It could also be possible that for them to eat the meal would have been for them to give allegiance and swear allegiance to Nebuchadnezzar, whom they said in their hearts they would not give allegiance to. They would work for him. They would be faithful in his culture and in his kingdom and work for him, but they would not swear allegiance to him. And as you'll see, the rest of the book of Daniel is essentially filled with them giving their allegiance to God alone. And that could be a possibility. But most likely the reason why they refused to eat the king's meat was, or the food meal, was essentially because the meal was comprised of food prepared improperly according to the law in the first five books of the Bible, or it could have been food that was forbidden, that they were not supposed to eat. And so they said, we will not defile ourselves with the portion of the king's food. And as a result, these four young men basically say, look, we cannot do this. And they risked their heads. And of course, as we saw last time, essentially what they said is test us for 10 days. Give us essentially only things that are grown from the ground, whether it be wheat or vegetables or beans or things like that. And they're tested for 10 days, and the guard finds them healthier and more strong and better looking than the other men who were eating the very fine meal that the king had given to them as well. And then you get to verse 18. Then at the end of the days, which the king had specified for presenting them, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and out of them all, not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. As for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in his realm. So essentially, the king examines them and finds them to be greatly blessed and wise and skillful above all the other men who had been taken captive, the other young men, I should say. And Daniel closes out chapter 1, which, from my estimation, is an introduction to the entire book of Daniel, with this comment. I mean, Daniel continued into the first year of Cyrus the king. In other words, Daniel had longevity. He was blessed. He lived a long life, and he continued through many different reigns and kingdoms. And all of that precludes chapter 2. And we get to chapter 2, finally. And as we think about chapter 2, I just wanted to say something that I had been thinking about the last couple of weeks, and that is, you think in terms of different nations, different countries, and you look over the course of history, you note that so many nations and countries and peoples have risen and fallen, right? There have been nation after nation who have risen to great prominence and then eventually became weak and fell in light of another nation rising to prominence and with greatness. And all of that is under the purview and the governing hand of God. No matter what happens in the world, no matter what happens in the nations, all of it is under the governing hand of God. And Daniel chapter 2 is an excellent, excellent illustration of that principle. Because in Daniel chapter 2, we have a very interesting account, again, with one of the principal characters of the first half of the book, Nebuchadnezzar. And so let's go ahead and dive in to Daniel chapter 2. And we'll just go a couple of verses at a time. Daniel chapter 2, verse 1 says, now in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. Now, stop there for a second. You say, okay, wait a minute. This is in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar. And most of you probably know this story well enough to know that essentially Daniel is brought in, excuse me, Daniel's brought in as one of these people who eventually will reveal the dream per God's revelation. And you say, wait, I thought that it wasn't until the third year that he had been with Nebuchadnezzar that Daniel was finally recognized and acknowledged by the king. So how could it be in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar that Daniel is a part of this story? Because if it were really in the second year, then that essentially means that Daniel was still undergoing the testing period that we described just a moment ago in chapter number 1. And the answer to this is basically the same as when we talked about chapter 1 and verse 1, when it says in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, and then you have the same comment made in, I believe, I can't remember, Jeremiah or Isaiah. But essentially, the fact that it was in the fourth year of the reign of Jehoiakim, you're like, aha, so here's a discrepancy in the scriptures. The liberals just love it when they can find what they believe are discrepancies and seemingly incongruent concepts or verses or ideas. And the answer is still the same here, that Daniel continues to use this Babylonian calendar, because as I described last Sunday, Daniel is a Jewish man, young man at this point, in a Babylonian pagan Gentile culture. And the Jewish calendar was very different than that of the calendar of the Babylonian Empire. Because in the Babylonian Empire, when a king went to reign, if he went to the reign in the middle of the year of the previous king who had passed away, that wasn't his first year of reigning. The rest of that year, even though the king previously had died and he was now reigning, was still considered as part of the year of the previous king who had passed. So the first year of the reign of the next king really was the beginning of the next full year that he reigned. And that time period between when he got to the throne to when it starts that first actual year, they called the year of accession. So it wasn't considered that wasn't considered his first year. So when you look here, it says in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, what most likely is happening here is that this is now in the middle, or at the end of that 3-year period that Daniel describes in Daniel chapter 1. In fact, that probably had just happened. That had just happened before these events. And you say, well, we're going to get here in a second, but how come all of his other wise men and counselors and people skillful in interpreting dreams, how come Daniel isn't among them? Well, just because Daniel and his friends had definitely gone through and proved themselves very wise and to stand out above the rest of the others in their class, if I could use that word, doesn't mean that Nebuchadnezzar would have necessarily just immediately turned to them and completely foregone any of his senior advisors that he had for perhaps many years, even under his father's reign, Nabopolassar, that he would just dismiss them. They probably had seniority. So what probably happened, if you're thinking of a timeline, is chapter 1 has just ended. Nebuchadnezzar has examined these people. He has essentially found that amongst all these exiles of the Jewish people, that there were none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And so, they begin working for him. But Nebuchadnezzar continues to rely heavily on his senior advisors. So now, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, or essentially right at the end of chapter 1, Nebuchadnezzar, it says, had dreams or dreamed dreams. And you say, wait, dreamed dreams, why is that so significant? Well, it's likely that Nebuchadnezzar was either in a state of dreaming, you know, as if he's just laying on his bed dreaming, or it's possible that he had one dream, or it could be possible that he had multiple dreams. And it says, because of this dream that he had, his spirit was troubled and his sleep left him. You can understand then that this was very significant in their culture. Dreams were thought to convey things about the future. Dreams were thought to convey things that were revealed from the gods. And so when Nebuchadnezzar has this dream, it incredibly bothers him. And this is why, if you're taking notes, the first point here, if you're taking the outline, the first point here is Nebuchadnezzar's problem. Because Nebuchadnezzar has this dream. And we'll find out what the dream is in a moment. I guess technically we'll find out what the dream was tonight, the way I've divided the chapter. But Nebuchadnezzar has this dream, and it bothers him. And so he gives orders in verse 2, that the king gave orders to call in the magicians, the conjurers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. So now, remember, like I said, Daniel and his three friends would have been in this group of people who would have been the ones interpreting the dream. But because they're still young, they're essentially like apprentices, they're probably not in this group of men. These are really his senior advisors that he is relying on. And Nebuchadnezzar's problem continues in verse 3 as he explains it to these men. He says that the king said to them, I had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to understand the dream. And like I said, in their culture, when you have a dream like that, this is obviously a very significant thing. This is something that from Nebuchadnezzar's perspective, he wants to really, really understand what this means. And I believe that he's really troubled, not because he personally cannot totally understand it, although that's part of it, but because the Lord is bothering him. As we'll see as we get through the rest of this account, the Lord is the one who has given him the dream. And so Nebuchadnezzar is bothered not simply because in his culture, dreams were important, but because the Lord is bothering him and setting the stage for himself to be glorified through Daniel. So he tells his leaders, his conjurers, sorcerers, the Chaldeans, he tells them, my spirit wants to know this dream. I really want to know it. And so what do they tell him? Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic. This is really interesting. Those of you who have taken some of my class on bibliology back in July, you'll remember that I said the Bible was written in three languages primarily. It was written in Hebrew and in Aramaic and in Greek, Koine Greek. Well, here, when it says the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, the rest of verse 4 in chapter 2 all the way through the end of chapter 7 is actually written in Aramaic. So chapter 1 all the way through the beginning of chapter 2, verse 4 has been written in Hebrew. And then from the quote, essentially, of these Chaldeans all the way to the end of chapter 7 is written in Aramaic. So if you ever wonder, well, where in the Bible was it ever written in Aramaic? I always thought all of the Old Testament was Hebrew, all of the New Testament was Greek. Here in chapter 2, verse 4, all the way through chapter 7, you have Aramaic as part of the language of the scriptures. So the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic. They say to him, O king, live forever. And that's essentially something they would have said in their culture. It was a sign of respect for the king. O king, live forever. Tell the dream to your servants, and we will declare the interpretation. Now stop there for a second. It would be no surprise that this group of people is very similar to the group of people in Exodus. Remember, in Exodus, you got Moses, who has been called by God to lead the Israelite people out of captivity in Egypt. And the Lord hardens Pharaoh's heart so much so that he uses men like these conjurers, magicians, sorcerers. He uses men like this to harden Pharaoh's heart. You say, how did he do that? Well, you'll recall that as Moses goes to Pharaoh and says, thus says the Lord, thus says Yahweh, let my people go. And Pharaoh basically says, no, I will not. And Moses shows him a sign, the first one being throws his staff down on the ground, turns into a snake, which is a very clear miracle. There is no sense in which that was a conjurer's trick. This was clearly a miracle from God sent to authenticate Moses' message and to glorify God and to show Pharaoh who he was dealing with. But what does Pharaoh's magicians and astrologers and all of these conjurers come up with? They throw their staffs down and it becomes sticks, they become snakes as well. And the question in several people's minds is, well, was that actually demonic power? You know, the fact that they threw their sticks down and it turned into snakes, or was this conjurer's tricks? And I've had a conversation with several close friends, and I'm not sure, Pastor Dixon, I'm not sure where you would be on this, but I personally believe that these conjurers, these sorcerers, these magicians were all charlatans who were able to use trickery to try to mimic, I should say, the true miracles that the Lord does. And think about it. That's exactly what Satan does. It's consistent with all of Satan's message. Everything that God does, Satan tries to create his own false version of it. But what is Satan? Christ describes him as the father of lies. When he's talking with the Pharisees, he says, you're of the father of the devil. Satan is the father of lies. So Satan is the ultimate trickster. He is the ultimate person who wishes to deceive people. And that's what he's been doing ever since the Garden of Eden. He has been seeking to deceive people with his trickery. And so I believe all the way back in Exodus, you have an illustration of people who were deceiving and being used by Satan to deceive and to further harden Pharaoh's heart. Well, I believe that same trickery, that same sleight of hand, if you will, conjuring, is similar to these group of men here in Daniel chapter 2. Now, I'm not saying that they were trying to deceive Nebuchadnezzar, but I think their trickery is being exposed here, which is very ironic because this is a part of the entire culture of the Babylonian Empire, of the pagan nations, and that is that these people somehow had some interesting connection to the false deities, had some kind of connection with some spiritual connection with the stars and stargazing and the writings and secret writings. And what happens here is these guys are about to get exposed by the very highest king of their land for the charlatans they actually are. So they say to the king, "O king, live forever. Tell us to your servants. Tell the dream to your servants, and we'll declare the interpretation. Look, King Nebuchadnezzar, we're more than happy to tell you and make you feel better and tell you what your dream is." So really, in some senses, you have Nebuchadnezzar's problem seemingly solved. Because here are these men, and I will say there's probably several of them, many men, who are prepared to answer what the king's dream was. And look, they're probably thinking, all right, the king's going to tell us certain elements of this dream, and we'll just go to our little magic books, and we'll read and try to draw all the comparisons, and then we'll give him an interpretation based off of that. So I'm sure they probably had some kind of set of books and conjurers, magical things that they would have focused in on. And so they're prepared if they have the information. But King Nebuchadnezzar is no fool. In fact, it's really interesting. He is perhaps one of the wisest pagan kings in some ways that you could see in all of Scripture. And I don't say wisest in the sense that he was completely wise, as in like Daniel. I mean, like, compared to human standards, this guy was very shrewd. He was very shrewd. And he recognizes that these conjurers would love nothing better than to give him an answer based off of their conjurers' tricks and books. And they are essentially prepared to give him the interpretation of this dream. But, as I said before, the Lord is the one who's pressing on Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar is being bothered of this dream by the Lord himself. And I believe that not only does the Lord bother Nebuchadnezzar, but the Lord actually is essentially causing Nebuchadnezzar to not even trust anything that these men say. He's orchestrating these events to eventually lead it to Daniel, as we'll see in just a moment. But he doesn't take them at their word. In fact, he is so bothered by this dream, he wants to know what the interpretation exactly is. And he, in his mind, thinks, I know there's one way that I can know that this interpretation they give is true. And he explains it in verse 5. The king replied to the Chaldeans, "The command from me is firm." Now, we'll get back to that in a second, but the King James, I believe, says the thing is gone from me, I believe is what it says in the King James. "If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you will be torn limb from limb, and your houses will be made a rubbish heap," or the King James, "a dunghill." So you've got King Nebuchadnezzar, who is not very pleased with these guys, because he could see right through them. And that phrase in the King James, if I remember correctly, it says, "The thing is gone from me." The question that you have to ask is, what is gone from him? Is he talking about, is this thing that's gone from him, is that a reference to the dream? In other words, did Nebuchadnezzar forget his dream? Or is he saying, "The thing is gone from me," the thing referencing his command? In other words, this command is firm. It's come from me. I am not changing my command. You must tell me what my dream is. You must make known to me the dream. And some have said, yeah, I think it leans more towards that he had forgotten the dream. But I'm not necessarily convinced that he forgot the dream. There, of course, like anything, if you've ever had a dream, you know, sometimes you don't remember your dream. Sometimes you have a dream, right? I know this has happened lots of times. You have a dream. And you think, wow, like that, you wake up immediately and you think, wow, that was a really cool dream. And then half hour later, you can't remember and you think, oh, I wish I could remember that dream. I don't know if that's necessarily a part. I mean, Nebuchadnezzar may have forgotten aspects of his dream, but I think he must have remembered it well enough, because if you think about it, he basically wants them to tell him what the dream is. Well, how can he know if he's forgotten it, if they've basically said the right dream? He's got to be able to know at least the general aspects of the dream in order to verify that what they're telling him actually was his dream, if he has in fact forgotten it. So I tend to believe that what the king is referring to when he says, this thing is gone from me, the thing is gone from me, or as the New American Standard says, the command from me is firm. I think the idea is that essentially he's saying, I am not changing my mind. What I have said is true. You need to not just tell me the interpretation of this dream, which you can tell has greatly bothered me, but you must also tell me what the dream was. And if you do not tell me what this dream is, then I'll know that essentially you are a charlatan and that you will face my judgment and wrath, and you will be torn limb from limb and your houses will be made a dunghill or a rubbish heap. And then he says in verse 6, but if you declare the dream and its interpretation, you will receive from me gifts and a reward and great honor. Therefore, declare to me the dream and its interpretation. And you got to think, these conjurers, magicians, sorcerers, astrologers, Chaldeans, they got to be thinking, oh boy, they're starting to sweat. What do we do? We cannot tell him the dream. And so they say in verse 7, they answered the second time and said, okay, let the king tell the dream to his servants and we'll declare the interpretation. And boy, Nebuchadnezzar is starting to get heated at this point. He's really getting upset. Verse 8. The king replied, I know for certain that you are bargaining for time, inasmuch as you have seen that the command from me is firm, that if you do not make known the interpretation of the dream to me, there is only one decree for you, for you have agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation is changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, that I may know that you can declare to me its interpretation. See, he just said, here's why I want you to tell me what the dream is, so I know that your interpretation is true. He wants the true interpretation. And if you think about it, that is a fascinating statement from King Nebuchadnezzar. Here is a pagan king, a Gentile king, who has been given this dream from God. And any of the pagan kings of that day would probably not have been as bothered about their dream as Nebuchadnezzar is in this moment. But he has this unwavering desire to know the truth. He wants to know the truth. And he wants to know the truth very, very ardently. He will not accept anything that these guys tell him. And these guys just begin to sweat. They're thinking, what do we do? We're sunk. We can't tell him the dream. And they say in verse 10, they answer the king and say, there is not a man on earth who could declare the matter for the king, inasmuch as no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this of any magician, conjurer, or Chaldean. Basically, they say, look, there is no human being on this earth who could actually tell you what your dream is, which is fascinating. They're absolutely right. Here these pagan sorcerers, magicians, astrologers, Chaldean, these pagan people who are espousing their wickedness in their profession actually say something that's very true. There is not a man on earth who can declare the matter for the king. No man on earth. And here is Daniel. As he's writing this down, you can just imagine. Daniel's writing this down. And he's just got this smile on his face as he's writing this down, because he knows what's coming. Obviously, this is all past history at this point, and he's writing this down. And he gets a smile on his face as he writes those words, because here is the irony, the great irony. Here are these men who supposedly are the interpreters of dreams, and yet they acknowledge this fundamental truth, that no mere human being can do such a thing. In fact, if you were to think about it further, they're saying, why can no human being do this? Because no human being can read a mind. I cannot know. There are, what it looks like, so there's 60 participants here, at least 60 devices that are tuned in here. And the only one of all 60 of these people that I can read the mind of is myself. I can only know what I'm thinking. I can't know what any of you are thinking inside your mind. And it's really interesting to think that if you think of these conjurers, magicians, astrologers, Chaldean religious diviners, who are most likely influenced by Satan's deceptions. Remember, I compared them to the magicians in Exodus, who I believe were influenced by Satan. That they cannot read the king's mind and interpret his dream. And this was an interesting point. I was listening to a sermon based off of this text, and the pastor made this same point. That Satan, if he really wanted to somehow destroy or to misinterpret and pollute the dream that the Lord had given to Nebuchadnezzar, you'd think that he would do it if he could read Nebuchadnezzar's mind and know his dreams, right? Because if you think about it, if Satan recognized that this was the Lord giving him the dream, then Satan would have probably immediately gone to these astrologers, sorcerers, diviners, magicians, and conjured up some kind of way for them to interpret a false way that dream. And he would reveal to them that dream, but Satan doesn't. And these guys cannot tell the king what his dream is, because no man can. And an interesting thought that this pastor I was listening to had brought out is that most likely Satan couldn't either. Or at least this could be an illustration of that thought, that Satan cannot necessarily know or read your thoughts because he's not God. God knows the thoughts and intents of the heart, but Satan doesn't. And so it's so interesting that Nebuchadnezzar says, I want to know that this interpretation is true, and I will know it's true if somebody can read my mind and know what the dream was. These guys even go further as they protest against the king and say, no man, no human being can understand this. They go further in verse 11. Moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult, and there is no one else who could declare to the king except the gods, whose dwelling place is not with flesh. Once again, they almost get it right. At least they're close. They say there's no human being who can interpret this, who could tell you what the dream is, except the gods can. The gods can. And they're close, because there's only one God. And Daniel will come in and display that truth before these men and before King Nebuchadnezzar. So they say, only the gods can do this. I was reading in my devotions this morning from Isaiah 47, and it was really interesting how this kind of coincides with what's going on here. In chapter 47, kind of a lament for Babylon in Isaiah 47. He says in verse 1, come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground with a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no longer be called tender and delicate. So he's talking about the Babylonian people, Chaldeans. You get down to verse 12. And he says, stand fast now in your spells and in your many sorceries with which you have labored from your youth. Perhaps you will be able to profit. Perhaps you may cause trembling. You are wearied with your many counsels. Let now the astrologers, those who prophesy by the stars, those who predict by the new moons, stand up and save you from what will come upon you. The people who are the supposed heroes and saviors for the Chaldean culture, as Isaiah describes here in Isaiah 47. Could not save the king in Daniel 2. They could not tell him the interpretation. They could not tell him the dream. And so the king, in verse 12, says, because of this, the king became indignant and very furious and gave orders to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. And so the decree went forth. That the wise men should be slain, and they look for Daniel and his friends to kill him. And if you think about this, Nebuchadnezzar is just incensed. Here he wants his most trusted people, his astrologers, his magicians, all of these people who supposedly have a connection to the gods and to these ancient mystical things that will help protect the kingdom, and essentially they aren't giving him anything. They can't help him at all. And the king just goes into this rage. He flies into an incensed rage and says, kill them all. I don't want any of them. Kill every single one of them. And this rage is just blind. He wants everybody dead. He wants his senior advisors dead. He wants these young captives from the exile who have just gone through this training process for almost 3 years. He wants them dead. And the king's problem goes from bad to worse, basically, because now not only does he not know his dream, but he won't have, from his perspective, anybody who can interpret it. And it'll bother him to no end, but at this point he just doesn't care. He has been rebelled against by these conjurers, and he believes that they essentially are holding out on him and have been tricksters and charlatans from the beginning. And so he sends out this decree that all of them die. And that's Nebuchadnezzar's problem, verses 1 through 13. You can see, I mean, sets the stage. For any reader reading Daniel's book, the Jewish reader is probably thinking, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen? Daniel and his friends are going to die. Because in verse 13, that's how it closes. So they look for Daniel and for his friends to kill them. But now we go from Nebuchadnezzar's problem, number 2, to Daniel's prudence. Nebuchadnezzar's problem in verses 1 through 13, Daniel's prudence in verses 14 through 16. It says in verse 14, then Daniel replied with discretion and discernment to Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard, who had gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. You can see an instant contrast between Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar is incensed. He is just in a rage, in a blind rage. He cannot think straight. And Daniel shows discretion, character, discernment. And this, we're talking about a young man, a man who's probably close to his late teens now, 17 years old. And Daniel is showing the exact opposite character. He's showing prudence, in contrast to Nebuchadnezzar. And he talks with this guard who comes to get him. And I think it's so interesting that this guard doesn't immediately just go in and kill him. And Daniel says in verse 15, he says to Arioch, the king's commander, for what reason is the decree from the king so urgent? And then Arioch informed Daniel about the matter. I mean, Arioch almost seems like he has a relationship with Daniel. You got Arioch, who was sent from the king to go and kill all these people. And here, Daniel says, hey, before you kill me, why are we dying? And Arioch's like, oh, okay, here, I'll tell you. Arioch just kind of lays out to him, oh, yeah, so the king had a dream. He doesn't know what to do. He told these guys, you need to tell me not only the interpretation of the dream, but you need to tell me what the dream was. And they couldn't do it. They basically said, you know, no human being can do it. Only the gods can do that. So tell us what the dream is and we'll interpret it. And man, the king just flew into a rage and said, kill them all. So yeah, unfortunately, Daniel, I got to come over here and kill you and your three buddies. So Daniel, showing the exact opposite reaction of the king, goes over. Verse 16. So Daniel went in and requested of the king. Here's the boldness of Daniel, the very king who has just sent out guards to go kill him. He goes before, and he requested of the king that he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation to the king. So think about the contrast of Daniel and these Chaldean astrologers and conjurers and soothsayers. These guys are stalling for time, right? When Nebuchadnezzar says, all right, tell me the dream and the interpretation. They're like, all right, yeah, you tell us the dream and we'll tell you the interpretation. He's like, I can tell you're just trying to buy time. Tell me the dream and the interpretation. And they're like, tell us the dream and we'll tell you the interpretation. They keep trying to buy for time. And the king will have none of it. And that's when he just gets angry and he goes and says, kill them all. I don't want them anymore. Then you get Daniel, calm, collected, showing prudence, discernment, discretion, goes in face to face with this angry king. And what does he do? he asks for the exact same thing that these conjurers, astrologers, soothsayers all asked for. Time. Daniel went in and requested of the king that he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation to the king. And it doesn't say it out loud, explicitly. But the king grants that. And this just shows you two things. Number one, this shows you the incredible character of Daniel. Daniel is such a young man, 17 years old, of character. And listen, if there are any teenagers tuned into the live stream right now, I'm telling you, there's a reason why Daniel has been one of my favorite Old Testament characters ever since I can remember, even from when I was a kid. Because Daniel shows that you can be a person of character regardless of how old you are, or regardless of your circumstances. Because Daniel, if you think about it, is in horrible circumstances. But he shows calm. He shows discretion. He shows discernment. He shows prudence. And what ends up happening? As a result, the king grants to him the time he requested. Which goes to show you that the king must have somehow calmed down. Said, instead of being in this incensed rage and saying, just kill them all. And Daniel comes in requesting her time, says, kill him right there, I don't care. The king grants him time. And Daniel displays such incredible prudence. And so the king gives him time. And so Daniel in verse 17, we go from Daniel's prudence, then number 3, to Daniel's petition. So verses 1 through 13 was Nebuchadnezzar's problem. Verses 14 through 16 was Daniel's prudence. Now verses 17 through the first part of verse 19, number 3, we have Daniel's petition. It says in verse 17, then Daniel went to his house and informed his friends Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah about the matter, so that they might request compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his friends would not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. So what does Daniel do? This man of prudence, this man of discernment, this young man of character, goes and finds other godly young men. And he seeks essentially to implore them to appeal to the Lord. Because Daniel recognized in the truest way that the astrologers and magicians and soothsayers at least hinted at earlier. And that is, only God could reveal the dream. And I wonder if Daniel, as he did this, in the back of his mind, wondered, Lord, did you give this dream to him? Is this why this is all happening? Because, looking back, as we look at scripture, we could be like, oh yeah, it's obvious God gave him the dream, but Daniel's living this out. He's just a little, 16, 17 year old kid. And I wonder, did he really know that the Lord was the one who had given the dream? And I think, in some senses, he must have, because he appeals to this same Lord to give him that interpretation. And it says in verse 18, so that they might request, notice this, I think King James says mercy from the God of heaven, compassion from the God of heaven. Essentially, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah say, Lord, we don't know what to do. We're going to die unless you do something. So we request that you would show mercy to us. Please help us know what this mystery is. Help us understand this dream and the interpretation. Give us this. Please give this to us so that we don't be destroyed. This is Daniel and his friend's petition. They appeal to the Lord. And that's what a person of character does who is a Christian. Person of character who needs wisdom. What does James say? If any of you lack wisdom, let him what? Ask of God. That's exactly what Daniel does. He asks of the Lord. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. the beginning of knowledge, Proverbs 1 tells us. And Daniel recognized those principles. And so he goes and appeals to the God of heaven, the one who knows all things. And what happens? It says in the first part of verse 19, then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. And we know who it was that did it. The Lord God of heaven is the one who revealed this mystery. And so we move then, finally, from Nebuchadnezzar's problem and Daniel's prudence and Daniel's petition to number four, Daniel's praise. And really, I'm dividing praise into two here. Daniel's praise goes from verses 19 through 30, but I'm splitting this with two more points here. And that is, number one, Daniel's praise begins with adoration to the Lord in verses 19b through verse 23. Because in verses 20 through 23, you have Daniel give and offer a prayer of praise to the Lord. And it says in verse 19, then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. And Daniel said, let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. Notice the contrast. Nebuchadnezzar thinks in his mind, wisdom and powers belongs to him. But Daniel, as he recognizes, God has given him the interpretation of the dream as well as the dream itself, that wisdom and power do not belong to the greatest king in his day of the known world, but rather it belongs to the God of heaven. Who, verses 21, it is he who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. It is he who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and power, for now you have made known to me what we requested of you. And notice he says, you are the one who did this, Lord, for you have made known to us the king's matter. Just a couple of thoughts, because our time is quickly fleeting. Essentially, Daniel acknowledges several things. One, God sets up kings. Two, he is the one who grants wisdom to any people. As we already saw, that's a timeless principle. He is the one who reveals the profound and hidden things, and he knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. That essentially is preparing you for what this dream is about to tell us, as we'll see tonight. But it's also preparing you for the rest of the book. Because Daniel, especially in chapters 7 through 12, is going to be revealing several future things, as well as in this chapter, as a matter of fact. And he acknowledges that it is the God who does this. And so when the reader, as he's reading the book of Daniel, sees all of these prophecies happening, guess what he's thinking now? The Lord's the one who does this. And now as Daniel describes this, who really is the one revealing these things in the future? It's not Daniel. It's the Lord. It's the Lord. And so he gives praise to the Lord. His praise, Daniel's praise, begins with adoration to the Lord. And that's in verses 19 through 23. And now, finally, Daniel's praise goes from adoration then to acknowledgement in verses 24 through 30. We'll go very quickly through this. So after his praise, his adoration to the Lord, therefore, verse 24, Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and spoke to him as follows. Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me into the king's presence, and I will declare the interpretation to the king. So then Arioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence and spoke to him as follows. I have found a man whom the exiles from the exiles of Judah who can make known the interpretation to the king. Which is interesting. He says, I found him. That's an interesting way of putting that. But I believe Daniel's the one who had gone to him. And so now Nebuchadnezzar sees Daniel, and he says to him in verse 26, the king said to Daniel, whose name is Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? You can almost sense the skepticism in Nebuchadnezzar's voice. Because here, he has basically been told by his most trusted advisors, his senior advisors, that only the gods can reveal this. No mere man can. And so he sees this mere man come to him. He says, are you really able to? Really? And what does Daniel tell him? Well, here's where we start getting the acknowledgement. Verse 27. Daniel answered before the king and said, as for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, conjurers, magicians, or diviners are able to declare it to the king. However, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he will make known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. This was your dream and the visions in your mind while on your bed. Essentially, Daniel says, you had all of your senior advisors, all of these magicians and conjurers and soothsayers, all of these guys who could not reveal this dream to you. But I want to tell you something. And Daniel immediately takes all of the focus away from him. This is just fascinating. This is so good. Daniel takes away the focus from himself and immediately gives attribution, acknowledgement to God, because he says there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. Isn't that great? He reveals mysteries. We're talking about the God of heaven. And not only does he reveal mysteries, but think about this privilege, Nebuchadnezzar. He has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. Nebuchadnezzar, there is a grand God of heaven who alone can reveal mysteries. And he has chosen to give you this dream. And you may be thinking, well, why Nebuchadnezzar? Why give it to Nebuchadnezzar? Why does Nebuchadnezzar get this dream about the future? And I think there could be several reasons why. But one, if you think about it, Nebuchadnezzar is one of the most written about of the pagan kings of that day. He's one of the most written about. And Nebuchadnezzar is the greatest king from the human perspective in that day. In fact, perhaps even in all of this time period, he's one of the greatest kings. And remember who Daniel is writing this for. Daniel's writing this letter, or this letter, this book, to encourage the hearts of Jewish people who were wondering, is God done with us? What's going to happen to us now? Is God done? Or is it all over? Are God's promises null and void now? And here the Lord essentially says, I am giving to this pagan king, the one who has judged you, whom I have used as my hand of judgment, to know what will happen in the future. But I also think it's a pretty high platform. I mean, we're talking about the grandest king of the land is getting this dream. That's so interesting to me that God has chosen to give to Nebuchadnezzar, one of the greatest kings in all of that known world, this dream. It's a grand stage if you think about it. And Daniel closes verses 29. As for you, O king, while on your bed, your thoughts turn to what would take place in the future. So think about this. He's on his bed. He's in his room. He's on his bed. It's most likely night. Nebuchadnezzar's thinking, what's going to happen in the future? What's going to happen to my kingdom? I mean, he's probably thinking, my dad, Nabopolassar, died. He probably didn't know what was going to happen after he died. So Nebuchadnezzar might be wondering, what's going to happen to me? What's going to happen to my kingdom when I'm gone? And so he says, your thoughts turn to what would take place in the future. And he who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place. So Nebuchadnezzar, you were wondering what's going to happen in the future. And let me tell you, the God who knows what will happen in the future has revealed to you what will happen. Nebuchadnezzar had to have been sitting in his throne thinking, wow, Like, I was just thinking about it, and now this God knows. How is this gonna work? Is he actually gonna tell me my dream? Nebuchadnezzar has to be wondering now. I'm waiting to hear this. And Daniel finally acknowledges as well that nothing about him has made this dream possible, has made this interpretation and dream revelation possible. As for me, this mystery has been revealed to me, has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me more than in any other living man. But for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king and that you may understand the thoughts of your mind. Basically, Daniel says, look, this isn't me. I'm not giving you any kind of unique skill or wisdom that I have. This was revealed to me by this God who has given this dream to you. And he did it so that you may understand what you were thinking about. And then he goes into the dream. But that we'll have to wait for tonight, because it's fascinating. The dream is fascinating, and so is its interpretation. Well, I hope that you will join us tonight for the live stream. I think should be at 6 o'clock, same Zoom link, I believe, and look forward to finding out who this great dream means, and who are the nations that it represents. It's really, really fascinating, really good. I hope you'll come out tonight on Zoom and listen to the interpretation. All right, I'm going to have a word of prayer, and then we will be dismissed for, I think, a few minutes, maybe about 20 minutes or so, and then we'll reconvene, and I believe Tim Schenk will be teaching our next lesson in our doctrine series. So let's pray. God, I thank you so much that you are compassionate and merciful, that you spared Daniel and his three friends from the death, the imminent death that was coming their way because of an incensed king. Lord, I thank you that you revealed the dream and its interpretation to Daniel. Lord, you are the principal character of all of the book of Daniel. And Lord, you are the principal character of history because you are the one who governs it. And I pray, Lord, that you would help us never to lose that thought, that no matter what happens, you are the governing king who sits on your throne. And all that happens, happens according to your plan and your purposes. Lord, I pray that we would be encouraged to know that people of character like Daniel, you use for your purposes. Lord, I pray that if there are any young people here on the Zoom who are wondering if you can use them or what way you can use them, Lord, may they find courage and encouragement in seeing how you use a teenage young man who had character for your purposes, and you glorified yourself. Lord, I thank you so much for each person who joined us today, and I pray that you would please be glorified as we prepare for Sunday school here in a few moments. Dismiss us with your blessing, I ask in Christ's name. Amen.